أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله الذي لا يبلغ مدحته القائلون ولا يحصي نعماءه العادون ولا يؤدي حقه المجتهدون الذي لا يدركه بعد الحمم ولا يناله غوص الفطن ثم الصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين حبيب قلوبنا وطبيب نفوسنا وشفيع ذنوبنا سيدنا ومولانا أبي القاسم محمد وعلى بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين صاحب العصر والزمان خليفة الرحمن إمام الإنس والجان ولعن الله وعداهم أجمعين إلى يوم الدين أما بعد فقد قال الله وقوله الحق بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم فصير في الأرض فانظروا كيف كان عاقبة المكذبين صلوا على محمد وعلى محمد Bridging the gap, bridging today's generation gap has been our ongoing topic. Tonight is lecture number 3. Alhamdulillah, we have introduced the topic last night and the night before, talking about these issues that we find inside of our communities and families, where there seems to be a gap that is occurring between the parent and the child, between the elders and the youth inside of our communities. And in order for us to bridge that gap, we must understand how each other thinks and how each other works. We are dealing with two different absolute generations. Last night, I talked a little bit about how this gap occurs initially. I said that when the family first arrives from their respective countries into this country, they come as a minority. They come as a subordinate culture into a very dominating culture. And at that moment then, any group that comes in as a minority into majority has three choices. One is isolation, one is assimilation, and one is integration. I talked about these three very briefly yesterday. I said that most of us, majority of us, with the exception of maybe of a few, have chosen to integrate into this society, where we still hold on to our back home values and still somehow also accept and begin to learn these values. Now yes, there might be some people that you know that have completely assimilated where of course they have no remnant of any culture, any religion. Their names have changed, their kids are completely off the path, there's no sort of, you don't see them in any sort of programs in Muharram or the month of Ramadan, they've completely become part of this culture. But the majority of us have done our best to integrate into this society, to somehow figure out what works for us and what doesn't work for us in this society. Both parent and child. And I mentioned last time, the child is faster at integrating in society than the parent is, for several reasons. One, of course, is this idea that they are dealing with children who they need to impress faster than all of you need to impress. If you, in your respective companies and respective jobs as my elders, you're able to still hold on to your culture and your language and your names and those things that make you who you are without a lot of judgment at work. But at school, these kids aren't like that. At school, growing up, it's very difficult sometimes to be the different kid that perhaps has a different lahja in English, a different dialect in English, perhaps wears certain clothing. And so the kids are either forced to choose between the idea of being isolated and ostracized and bullied on one end, or become completely American on the other end. And so usually a child that comes in 8, 9, 10, 12 years old, he'll choose to become American quicker than he will the other path. And thus we have this gap that now occurs, where we have this parent at home looking to what uphold the Indo-Pak culture somehow, and a child now says, look, that culture is no good for me at school, I'm going to adopt this culture, because I'm easily more accepted in this culture. And so language and libas and all these things go out the window, because now they've completely become part of this culture, right? It is a fear of a lot of our parents, that to the point where when I talk to some parents across the continent, I'm surprised to find out that a lot of them who have been here for 20, 25 years, they flat out told me that, you know what, if I had the choice again, I wouldn't migrate here from my respective country. We were good where we were. Fine, let's say those of you who are from Pakistan right now, that's not the safest zone to be in, but at least my kid has family values. At least my kid has dini values. At least my kid respects our name. At least my kid doesn't go down a path that's destructive, but he's so worried about being accepted, doesn't see the destruction, right? So there is, and there continues to be, a lot of problems. Now today what I want to do is I want to make sure that each generation understands each other. So to my youth, to my kids in the audience, you have to understand where your parents are coming from. Right? Where they came from and their generation. Equally, the parents of today have to understand how the child of today thinks and how they view life. Everything goes down to world view, how you view the world. The kids view the world one way, our parents view the world another way. And this could be a discussion, those of you who have the kids at home, those of you who are grandparents at home, doesn't matter. You still have a stake in raising your grandchild. Nowadays, in this day and age, when you have young couples who have double incomes, need double incomes, they'll come and they'll drop their child off at your house and say, can you please, you know, look after my son for sometimes 6-7 hours a day. So now you're raising the grandchild all over again, right? So let's go through a little bit of both generations to understand where each one comes from. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Now the first generation are those of you who are from 50 to 75 years old. You are known as the baby boomers. Correct? And there are certain things in the baby boomer generation that my kids should understand. Number one is that they've been trained and they've been raised to be individuals who put forth effort in everything that they do. Doesn't matter if it's a very, very minute job, or they are, let's say, the CEO of a company. Okay? They put a lot of effort in everything that they do. Because they equate effort to their name. They think that if an individual is a lazy individual, that affects their name. And everything to this generation is how they're seen by other people. Number two is that they were never given anything freely growing up in India, Pakistan. They had to work hard for everything. If they asked for a new pair of shoes from their parent, the parent said, look, why don't you go work hard, save up some rupees, and I'll give you the other half, and you can go and buy another pair of shoes. And so everything was earned for them. That's why we have this immense problem inside of our parents where everything that they have and they own, they want to keep it. And they don't want to get rid of it. Right? So people's basements and people's garages, mashallah, are filled with things that are 30, 40 years old. Right? Ek din jo hai kaam aayega. That's their slogan. Ek din kaam aayega. There's a box of broken, rusted tools. If you God forbid go to throw it out, no, don't throw that out. That wrench one day, trust me, I'll need it one day. Right? And that ek din never comes. Right? And so there is this, you know, and even if you try to throw things out, it's all sentimental value. That's your first bib, that's your first crib, that's your first, it's all dusted and moldy and garbage. To you it's garbage, to them it's everything. Because they were always told, whatever you have, hold on to it. Appreciate it. Right? Use it until its very end. They don't quite understand that if your phone slows down while you get a new phone, that phone still works. If it takes an extra 10 seconds, fine. But to throw that whole phone out and buy a new phone to them is completely absurd. Right? Challa hai, challa do. It's okay, it's going. Let's keep going, right? So they will drive their car right into the ditch. They'll wear their clothes right until the buttons fall off. They'll live in their house until there's cracks in the foundation. They'll freeze food until the food goes bad. All these things come from a mentality that whatever you have, keep it, appreciate it, because it came with a lot of hard work. It came with sweat, blood, and tears. It wasn't handed to you. Right? So the moment that you say, oh, I spent this much, Dad, on this shirt, they'll sit there and say, come sit down for a second. Let me tell you what $50 meant to me back then. Right? And they'll tell you all about the fact that I could, you know, travel the world in $50, for example. Okay? And you bought a shirt, for example. But they come from a generation where everything, even the shirt on their back, came with my sweat and my blood and my tears. And so yes, there's a hoarding mentality, but it's not that they like to collect stuff. They just know that whatever I have, I want to hang on to it. Because everything was effort-based. Right? The idea that I have to provide for my family was their driving factor. So there are so many of you who are my elders who work 7 days a week. It doesn't matter what job it is. Security, flea market, taxi. It doesn't matter as long as my kids are fed when they're hungry. Nowadays, we have the children today that will say, you know what? I'll work here, but there's no way I'm flipping burgers. I'm not going to make photocopies at Kinko's. I'm not going to park cars. I'm not going to be an Uber driver. That's beneath me. Right? And meanwhile, their fathers come from an area where nothing was beneath them because they were the primary source of income for their family. That's their generation. They came from a generation where everything was effort. Everything was effort. Right? So when they came and they had their first house, I remember my father when he bought his first house, he was glowing because this was the combination of his sweat and blood and tears. Right? The first car, everything was a victory for them, a celebration for them. Because nothing was ever handed to them by their father. He was too busy trying to raise his own kids, let alone try to feed you what you need in terms of your shoes. That's the baby boomer generation. Try to understand, my youth, where your parents come from and why they don't understand sometimes your lifestyle, because they don't come from that lifestyle. Things were not handed sometimes, like they are sometimes to all of us, on a silver platter. That there you go. Not only am I, you know, giving you a car, but I'm paying your insurance and I'm filling up your gas and I'm giving you this, I'm giving you that. All you do is you drive around town. That mom, dad, I need gas money. That was unheard of back then. Right? So that's the baby boomer generation. Now let's come to the millennials. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. So hopefully you understand a little snapshot of how our parents look at life. Now there is a generation in between of those who are from about 35 to about 50. My generation. We'll leave that generation aside for a moment. The ones that are the younger ones that are called millennials. 18, 15, 16 to about 30, 35. Okay? Well, most of you are in this room. And to my fathers and my mothers who are listening, who are raising kids in this age, it's important that you understand how this generation works. Those of you who are seniors in your community, looking and begging to have these youth of this age come forward and take the reins over of the community, it's important that you understand how this generation works. This is a very crucial discussion to lay the foundation as we move forward. Now, these millennials are a very, very special group. In all aspects of the word. They're a unique generation. They are probably the most unique of all generations. And there's reasons for that. Now, of course, I'm generalizing. Yes, I know. Not everyone, all of you are like that. Not even our baby boomers are all like that. But I'm generalizing. This is based on research, not based on my own opinion. Now, how these millennials work, the first thing is that since they were a child, they're raised very differently than we were raised. They're raised to celebrate everything that they do. Everything that they do, small, big, large, whatever, they're given some sort of prize for their efforts. Okay? So for example, we have like, you know, if you come in eighth place in a race, you're given a ribbon nowadays. Okay? You're given a medal just to participate sometimes in a competition. In my era, it was first, second, third, and that's it. If you were fourth place, it's like you were last. There's nothing. You would cry, you'd be upset, but you'd be motivated next year to come back and be on the podium for second, third. Nowadays, if you even just arrived and attended, here's a medal for you, here's a trophy for you, here's a shabash and tali for you, because we don't want to upset the millennials. We don't want to upset this generation. Okay? So from day number one, they've always been number one, very, very special generation. Everything you do is special. Everything you do is celebrated. Everything you do is, oh, my kid, or my son, or my son. And that's fine. That makes sense. But when the child gets a little bit older, he adopts this mentality that the slightest little bit of effort should be awarded. So they honestly search for minimal effort. If I'm getting the same reward as an eighth place guy is, or a third place guy is, or a fourth place guy is, why am I striving to be anything better than I am right now? I'm at the exact same level. So they go through school like this, and then they end up in the workforce. In the workforce, you don't get eighth place ribbons in the workforce. You don't get medals just for showing up in the workforce. It's a very competitive work environment. School is a very competitive work environment. As many of you know, who are striving to be, let's say, doctors or lawyers or whatever you, the case may be. Everything is GPA. Everything is your MCAT score. Everything is this score, your SATs. All of it resides on one number. But up until now, you've been one place on this pedestal that you're the Shahzada. You can do no wrong. And so now they have this moment where they realize that, wait a second, I need to put some effort into it. And so what do? They leave. Because they have an equation. Your children, who are from 18 to 30, have an equation. And that equation is that ease equals value. Ease equals value. It's the millennial equation. That we search for things that are simple, because to us simplicity is value. If it's hard, it's not valuable for you. So they'll have a course, let's say in college, halfway through the course, this is impossible, too hard, drop the course. Retake it. They have a job, let's say, the job is too demanding, within 3 months, quit. What happened? You just got hired. It wasn't for me. They get into marriages, and the wife stresses him out. 3 months, divorce. Ease equals value. And they live in revolving doors. They live in revolving doors. They're known as a nomad generation. They're never stable in one spot. They're hopping everywhere. Wherever you see them, they're always somewhere else in life, because they're looking for that ease equals value. Now, mind you, I don't mean to, you know, come down too hard on you guys, but I do mean to say there's been a lot of good that has come from this generation. Everything that we have in terms of convenience today is because of this generation. Smartphones and apps and people like me that I can type in half a hadith online and libraries pop up, as opposed to me having huge books around. Back, I mean, when I was first starting in Tabligh, to prepare for one speech, hours and hours of research for one speech. Big, huge volume of books. 20, 30 pound books around me, flipping through pages and writing stuff down. Now, like I said, I type in Farsi and Arabic half the hadiths and the whole library pops up. That's because of these guys, these millennials. Right? Google Maps and Waze. I mean, back in the day, can you imagine now? This is how old I am. I used to call people for their address. Say, take the highway, then make a left, then make a right, then check and left, check, and I have to write it down. Can you imagine writing it down, writing something down? Can you imagine? And having it in front of you. Now you have Waze and you have Google Maps and you have this maps and that maps. That's all because of them. There's convenience. It's all about ease equals value. And the problem is that when they take that equation into the religion, it doesn't match. Because the religion is not about ease equals value. The deen is not about ease equals value. The deen is all about struggle equals success. Struggle equals success is the equation of the religion. So now you have this 19-year-old who is being pulled by two different sources. The deen says struggle, 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 and the youth says, I've never been taught how to struggle. Never been taught how to struggle. I was given a car, I was given a phone, I was given everything. I have my own room, I have my own TV, I have a closet full of clothes. I have everything given to me at my disposal. If I don't like it, I throw it out, I give it away. You know, there's, you know, Goodwill, for example. And I ask mommy and dad for, let's say, for some extra money. Again, I'm generalizing. So now they have this conflict. And they search for the easy ways inside the deen. And the deen is not easy at all. Okay, that's point number one. As you recite a salawat, please come a little bit towards the middle, please, and towards me, please. Please come forward, please come forward. Please come forward, please, thank you, thank you. We're trying to establish an understanding of both generations to somehow bridge this gap. Okay, we talked about the baby boomers, those of you who just arrived, and now we're really hammering on the millennials. Okay, but it's okay. It's important for all of you to understand who you are and who you're raising at the exact same time. The second point that's huge for these millennials is they are always looking for an impact. An impact. Go big or go home. That's their slogan. See? That's their slogan. Go big or go home. Right? It either has to be wow or nothing at all. And the deen is not go big or go home at all. Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam says, He says those acts in the eyes of Allah are more liked those acts that are small but consistent, as opposed to large but inconsistent. That's exactly what the hadith says. The deen is not go big, go home. The deen says go small, but go small every single day. This millennial generation is all about impact. Impact, impact. I want to make sure that if I am the one who's in charge of today's iftar, it's the best iftar Bayt al-Qaim has ever seen. If I'm in charge of tonight's program, oh, you watch what I do. Right? If I'm in charge of this youth program, if I'm in charge of that project at work, for example, if I'm the MC, I'm going to blow them away with my MC. Everything's all about impact, and that's great. The problem is this. An example I'll give you is a mountain. It's my favorite example, as you guys all know. The mountain. Where is the highest impact on the mountain? Say it. Where is the highest impact on the mountain? The top. The top is the highest impact. That's where you plant your flag. That's where you take your selfie. On top of the mountain. I got to the summit. I climbed the mountain to the summit. Top of the mountain. So this millennial now is looking at the mountain and his first glance is where? To the top. That's my impact. The problem is they don't see the mountain in the process. There's a mountain to climb. No one's going to airdrop you onto the top of the mountain. Whereas, for example, this generation, the baby boomers, their first thought is not the top of the mountain. They're thinking, where is my first step onto the mountain? That's the biggest difference. And the thing is, if they had identified there's no way I'm climbing the mountain on top of the top, it's too big, they won't even try the mountain. They'll look for a smaller mountain somewhere. Because ease equals value. This is the problem that we have. And the deen is not about sudden impact. The deen is very, very monotonous. It's very repetitive. It's very baby steps. It tells you 10 times a day, إِيَّاكَ نَعْبُدُ وَإِيَّاكَ نَسْتَعِينَ. Pound that home inside of you. It's so repetitive, it's so boring, yes it is, there's a reason for that. We're not worried about go big or go home, we're worried about this idea of going very, very slow but consistent. Constantly reminding, Maliki Yawm al-Din, Maliki Yawm, 10 times a day. Constantly. We're dealing with this generation that wants to see impact. The problem also is that why is it? Now, on top of all of this now, on all of this stuff, which really is, you know, elements of depression and stress and anxiety. You can imagine a 19 searching for impact wherever he goes, and sometimes there isn't any impact. Now, you put a smartphone inside of their hands. So they're at school and they're at work. There's no 8th place ribbons there. There's no participation medals there. It's a very competitive dog-eat-dog world out there. Okay? You have to make sure that you are a cut above the rest. They've never been trained like that before. So they lose jobs. Low GPAs, 6-year undergrads, divorce rates are up, family time is cut down to just, you know, you're sitting inside of a room at the table with your parents and your siblings and you're chatting with somebody else outside that room. Family trips are lame because they don't see the impact in it. Coming to the center is boring because they don't see the impact in it. It's the same center, sometimes the same speaker that comes in Muharram and the camps and Ramadan. Like, oh my God. It's 1,000 speakers, right? This guy keeps coming back. He keeps coming back for some reason. He burns himself on purpose so he can come here from Ramadan. That's how bad it is. It's all about impact. Right? And the problem is when you start to realize that, whoa, this world isn't just about the bang. It is about the fact that there's a gradual work ethic that our parents have identified. That you're not going to get things overnight. Then what ends up happening is depression takes over. And anxiety takes over. And stress takes over. Because they weren't given the tools to handle all this. Now you give that 18-year-old a numbing device like social media. They can drown themselves into Facebook and present this beautiful world. Like, I live this amazing life on social media because these kids are amazing to present themselves on Facebook. Like, you know what? My life is perfect. This is me on the weekend. These are my new shoes. Check out my new room. Look at the view from my window. Oh my God, they have it made. They have it made. Meanwhile, it's all numbing, numbing, numbing. Don't handle your things head on. Just numb them with social media. That's why there's an addiction. They'll wake up in the morning before they greet Allah or greet their spouse or greet their mother, they'll be on the phone to see, you know, what's the latest WhatsApp messages? Who liked my post? Who retweeted my tweet? What's the latest Snapchat? Who Instagrammed what from last night? Which hashtag is trending today? All these things are before one eye is even open properly. All because it's numbing. I don't want to face the world. I want to drown myself in this phone. They've actually done research to say that the social media, it triggers dopamine inside of you. You guys know what dopamine is. Dopamine is that internal force that is used sometimes for gambling, for alcohol, for cigarettes. It's an addictive force inside of you. It's funny how for cigarettes and for gambling and for alcohol, there's ages in this country. But for smartphones, there's no ages for this country. You give a 15-year-old a smartphone, say, okay, that's your phone. And I get it. Parents want to know where their kids are nowadays. I get it. But now a 15-year-old who's drowning in this idea of anxiety is numbing himself into the phone, and then you wonder why he can't hold a serious relationship in his whole life. Friendship, forget friendship. Do you guys have any friends or actual friends? They're all fake friends. They're all virtual friends. Maybe one or two actual good friends besides siblings that if you know at 3 a.m., that guy is there at 3 a.m. If I need X amount of dollars to bail myself out, that X amount of dollars is there for me. How many friends like that do you have? Why are divorce rates up? These kids fight the entire khandan to get married. The entire khandan to get married. Nay, I'm going to get married to her and nobody else. Okay, marriage happens. Everyone is razi. Everyone's okay. 6 months talaq. Because they were never trained or given the tools to hold an actual relationship together. It requires effort. It requires mehnat. Right? I was mentioning in the sisters only session there that a lot of you were very scared about. I'm not sure why. Hopefully that night, those of your wives were there with me. You guys were okay that night, inshallah. But I said that, you know, this istikhara idea for marriages. I'm sorry, it doesn't exist. We don't look for istikharas to see if that's a right guy or a right girl or not. Islam has already outlined what a right girl, a guy is. Istikhara won't give you a problem-free life. I mentioned that there's been, you know, couples who have come to me with problems for counseling, and they would say, well, Maulana, we asked for istikhara, but you are the one that looked at the istikhara. I was like, I know, but it doesn't mean that there's no problems in life, right? This is what we're doing, because they're not equipped with the right tools to be able to uphold a proper relationship. So they won't talk to you as parents. Because they'll numb themselves in social media. They'll numb themselves on the phone. And I'm not against smartphones or social media. I have both of them. I'm not against either one. But when it's used as a numbing device, when there is that imbalance, where I'm talking to you and you're doing this. Yes, I know. No, I hear you, Mom. Go ahead. Yeah. Well, I'm talking to you and you hear that there's a message in your pocket and you know you get physically uncomfortable because you haven't checked the message yet. Right? So it's haram? Okay, thanks. And you pick up the phone, you check the message. Right? This is what we're dealing with. It's a very difficult generation to motivate. Because they see themselves as an outward creation, and that's where the problem lies. Let's address that and move on. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Now, how do you motivate these individuals? How do you get the awareness to come towards you, the community, the family, etc., etc.? You have to give them a little bit of leeway to experiment. They're not somebody who wants to be confined to a certain method. They're not a generation that are robots. They actually believe that they have been created to, you know, free the world. That's why you see AI is a huge, huge science right now. You know, robots and all these things are huge because they really want to change the way they do things. So those of you in the community who are looking to have the youth come forward and take over the reins, give them a little bit of freedom. And I know it becomes very, like, you know, it's almost as if you're very uncomfortable, uljan almost, to watch them do the work sometimes. Because they forgot about this, they forgot about that, what about this, what about that? But you have to let them fall and slip and trip and do all that, get up and try again and again and again. Same way in the home. Give them actual responsibilities. Ask them, how is that that I can do this? Give them that rein, give them that key, let them do it their way. Because they'll search for the easiest way possible. Right? Because they are, you know, the word that's used for this generation, and I hate this word, is entitlement. Sometimes they feel entitled for some reason. So when they're told how to do things, that entitlement is gone. Until they get a little bit older and then they realize. Because they see themselves as nothing but this minute physical existence sometimes. And that's when I look to Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam. And he reminds us that the cure is inside of you and the sickness is also inside of you. He says the things that you are searching for sukoon and comfort and it's been on outside of you have always been inside of you all day long. It's a matter of you turning inwards and looking inside of you. And that's the part that scares this generation. They're scared to be alone with themselves. They go to the washroom with their phones. Because they're afraid to be alone with themselves. So when someone like me talks about contemplation and tafakkur, tadabbur, spend 1 minute, Baba, by yourself, close out the entire world and think, they can't do it for more than 30 seconds. I ask my generation who travel and commute every single morning, if you drive by yourself, turn the radio off, turn the phone off, you, the sound of traffic outside of you and your thoughts. A lot of us are scared of what might come out. And yet somehow if you're able to get through a minute, 2 minutes, three minutes, 5 minutes of contemplation, you might understand where am I headed, what do I need to do, and that will pave the way. Right? When Imam Muhammad Baqir alayhi salatu wasalam talks about 1 hour of contemplation is equal to a night of worship. Do we even have that moment where we can silence the soul, quiet the nafs? Sit there after salat for 5 minutes on the musalla with my head down and just kind of organize my thoughts. And we don't do it because we're scared of what might come out. We're scared of handling what might come out. We're used to numbing everything. Drown myself in social media. Drown myself in television. You know, get to the point where I'm on a screen until I fall asleep on the screen so I don't have to face my thoughts at night. This is a very dangerous method we're using. And my parents out there are trying to raise kids to be effort-based and responsible. To understand that you can't get anything free in this world. Because they've gotten nothing free in their world. And this is where the gap lies between both generations. Is that the youth don't understand the idea that why don't my parents progress? My parents have been living in the same house for 25 years. The carpet is old, the house needs, you know, they still use wallpaper, for example, in the living room. They have an old brick fireplace, for example. All this. You ask the parent, "Ye to hamara mahal hai malana. This is our Jannah. This is our palace. Why? Every brick has come from me. Every inch of drywall is from my mehnat and my zahmat. So this is a base, this is an effort, a reflection of me, of who I am. This is who I am." Whereas they don't see that. They see it as nothing but concrete and bricks. And so there has to be a little bit of a balance. And moving forward, we have to come a little bit forward to understand each other and how each other exists. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. As I do every single day, a quick masala about fasting in terms of the fiqh. A lot of things that sometimes we get questions about. One thing that is the first thing that breaks our fast, of course, as many of you know, is eating and drinking. Now, in terms of eating, some of you have asked the question, and every year it comes up. Let's say I woke up after Fajr and I'm brushing my teeth. And there are little bits of food from suhoor left inside of my teeth. And I can feel that. What do I do at that moment? There are two things that you should do. Number one is do your best to, of course, take it out. So gargle your mouth as much as possible. If it goes down by mistake, then your fast is okay. Don't worry about that. The second thing that happens sometimes is that I sometimes end up, you know, my gums end up bleeding sometimes. Okay, sometimes it happens. Our teeth bleed. What happens? Is my fast broken? No. Remember, one thing I'll say to you, there's a specific list of 10, 11 things that break your fast. Okay? Those are the only things that breaks your fast as you're fasting. There are other things that are haram in the deen that God forbid we might do while fasting that doesn't break your fast. It's not recommended, it's not a good idea, but it doesn't break your fast. Right? Shara'an, you're still in the state of fasting. If those 10, 11 things happen at that moment, of course, then your fast is broken. So many people say, oh, you know, for example, let's say I missed one salat, God forbid. I've stepped through Fajr, let's say, God forbid. Is my fast broken? It's not broken. It's not a good idea, but it's not broken. Unless those 10, 11 things are on there. If blood comes in your mouth, again, you do your best to spit it out. To get it as much up. If it continues to bleed, then a gauze or something to kind of stop it. At that moment, then you can continue fasting. It's not a big deal. But if a little bit of food gets in your mouth, it's okay. Even while some of you are cooking, but a little bit, with a little bit of ihtiyat. Even while you're cooking, if you're making today's iftar, for example, and you want to taste the namak or the mirchi, if it's too much or too little, even the sharia allows you to bring it to the tip of your tongue. Don't have a whole plate full, please. You come home here and there's halim on your beard. No, not like that. Not like that. That's enough, a little bit to know that you're not going to set us on fire when we are having iftar at night, inshallah. We ask you, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, to accept our amal, inshallah, and bless us in the month of Ramadan, inshallah. We ask you, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, to forgive our sins and those of our parents. We ask you, Allah, this daunting task of raising kids today and understanding our parents. We ask you, Allah, give us that tawfiq to understand each other and bridge that gap, inshallah. And finally, Allah, we ask you to make us istabil and worthy of the zuhur of Imam Zamana and make us his ansar when he comes. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.